The second case of the day, Rock Energy Cooperative versus the Village of Rockton.
Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Todd Gale, and I represent Rock Energy Cooperative, a consumer-owned utility that's been incorporated in the state of Wisconsin since 1937. We're here today on my client's appeal of the district court's judgment dismissing its complaint. That complaint sought a declaratory judgment that the defendant, Appalee, Village of Rockton, has not met the requirements of the Illinois Municipal Code to acquire certain gas and electric utility assets from my client.
Where does Rock Energy's right to sue in this case arise? Is it a statutory right under the Municipal Code?
It is.
What provision of state law gives Rock Energy the right to seek this declaratory judgment?
Rock Energy is the owner of the assets that are the subject of the ordinance that has been passed by the Village of Rockton. There are no other assets other than those owned by my client, Rock Energy Cooperative, that are the subject of that particular ordinance.
But let me follow up in a sense. If I wanted to sue the city of Chicago tomorrow, let's assume I own property in the city of Chicago, and I decided to bring a lawsuit saying, City of Chicago, please don't condemn my property, they would say that's premature. You know, we aren't condemning your property right now. Do they have the power of eminent domain? Yes. Can they condemn things for a public purpose, et cetera? Yes. But in your case, I don't see what the Village of Rockton has done to condemn your property.
What the Village of Rockton did was pass an ordinance.
I know they passed an ordinance, and I know all about, you know, the number of dollars, $35 million versus $48 million, and I know all of that. But what I don't see happening here is the filing or the commencement of an actual condemnation proceeding. And I don't think that this court has the authority to issue an advisory opinion telling the village whether it may or may not do that.
Certainly this court does not have the authority to issue an advisory opinion, and that is not what we seek. We seek a declaratory judgment, and the reason why
but
we
But that's
believe
an advisory opinion, the way you have it. And actually, to be honest, I'm going to just throw one more thing in. I can't imagine why you're so reluctant at this stage of the game to go to the state court, which is what the district court thought you needed to do, given the ruling of the state court judge about the MOU in the case that you filed as supplemental authority.
Let me take your first question first, if I might, and then I'll go to why we came to federal court and not to state court. I believe that the case of Davis versus Brown that we cite in our papers is instructive on whether or not we have a current and an actual and a concrete injury that has happened to us already. In Davis versus Brown, there was an ordinance passed by a village that they were, or excuse me, pursuant to state statute, the Illinois Department of Transportation filed maps with the state and identified an area where it might put a highway in the future. It had not yet condemned that land. It had not yet filed any sort of a lawsuit to take that land away from the landowners. But the landowners, based on the maps that had been filed, filed suit saying that there was now a cloud over their title to that land, and as a result of that, they had a present right to sue.
But I'm going to point out, that's a state case.
It is.
Standing and case or controversy in federal court is a federal question. It's not
that's
a
right.
And the Illinois courts would be free, as some state courts are, to have a looser standard on that. They could even give advisory opinions, as the Massachusetts courts do.
Right.
And so I'm not sure that there's anything in the Davis case that binds this court. And I would give you this hypothetical. Suppose the village took to heart your criticisms of the glitches that occurred with the referendum, with, you know, the $48 million being what's voted for and the $35 million being what's published and all the rest. And they just said, we really want these assets. Let's just have another referendum. Let's put it on exactly the way it should be. You wouldn't have a word to say if they created a new predicate for condemnation.
If, in fact, they created a new predicate, to use your
phrase. And they could do that.
They could. You're absolutely correct.
Which is what makes your case so
hypothetical.
The reason why, and I don't mean to quarrel with Your Honor, the reason why we see our case as not hypothetical and why we believe we have a direct injury that has already occurred is because they have passed this flawed ordinance directed only at our property. There is no other purpose for this ordinance but to give the village authority to acquire our property either by negotiation or by condemnation. As a non-home rule entity organized pursuant to Illinois law, without that ordinance, they would not have that authority. This was not a random act by the village.
What are you trying to do with the property at the moment other than just operate it?
We are operating it and we are delivering gas and electricity to the citizens of the village of Rock.
So in what sense have you suffered a present economic harm? And actually, in what sense would you suffer a future one if they paid fair market value?
Because we own this land, pursuant to Illinois substantive law, eminent domain authority needs to be strictly construed.
I understand that, yes. But if you get paid fair market value for your land, doesn't our capitalist system assume that fair market value is an exact equivalent of the assets you've exchanged?
Your question assumes a bit. It assumes that we would actually get fair market value.
Well, you're supposed to. It's a constitutional matter.
Right. And as Your Honor knows, the case books are thick with cases where people believe they are not receiving just compensation for their land pursuant to eminent domain.
They think that, but if it's not right, then if that doesn't get sustained in the courts, then they're wrong.
Well, that's all fair. That's all absolutely true. What we're arguing today is that their authority is flawed. And again, the reason from our perspective that we believe we have a current and a direct injury that has already occurred is because this is not just some ordinance that would give them some general right over some unspecified property. They are talking only about property owned by my client. Now, if I might, you asked me a question a few minutes ago asking
about... Aren't you happy to be in state court since you seem to be winning there? Yes.
So we were happy with the with what happened in state court related to the memorandum of understanding. Our case is sort of earlier in the decision tree, if you will, than the memorandum of understanding. Recall that the ordinance would give the village of Rockton the authority to acquire these assets either by negotiation or by condemnation. And the memorandum of understanding would have been a negotiation route. And you're absolutely correct, as we informed the court in our Rule 28J letter, that the village's lawsuit that was filed after our lawsuit and not before, which I think is important from a jurisdictional perspective, that lawsuit was dismissed because the memorandum of understanding does not have a price term. And so that memorandum of understanding has been held by the only court to adjudicate it to be unenforceable and ineffective.
Has that ruling been appealed?
The time for appeal has not yet run. It runs sometime, I believe, next week or this weekend, something like that. So it's not yet been appealed. My indication from conversations with counsel for the village, and he could certainly answer this question better than I, is that they do intend to appeal that ruling. At the pleading stage where we are, remember that we're here pursuant to the granting of a Rule 12 motion. All factual allegations in the complaint should be construed as in favor of my client to the extent possible. And it's also clear under federal law that one need not await the consummation of an injury before it has standing.
Well, but you can say that, but as you know, there is still a remoteness limit to that.
There is.
Because it's got to be a fairly imminent injury before the Declaratory Judgment Act will be satisfied, and indeed before there's actually a case or controversy for Article III purposes. And,
yes,
and
ma'am.
I guess I'm still disturbed at the thought that even though the village may have taken one step, which you are critical of, that's an issue I recognize, it seems to be a long way away from actually moving forward with condemnation. And reading the briefs as a whole in this case, they're what I like to call ships passing in the night briefs. You look at the red brief, and it's all about the election code, and you look at your brief, and it's all about the municipal code, and nobody's engaging with what anybody else is saying.
It is true that we address different issues in our respective briefs. Let me, if I might, though, address your concern about what has happened and what steps the village has taken. Let me start the timeline from January of 2005, when the village board approved two different ordinances and signed and notarized two different ordinances, each of which was designed to give them the authority to acquire my client's assets. Then the election happened in April 2005.
And their point is the voters actually authorized the greater amount of money, even though the map may not be attached to the one. But the voters said, fine, go out and spend $48 million. We're not going to limit you to $35,
right,
which was the published version.
Well, that's true. But the question there, from our perspective, is whether pursuant to 11-117 Section 3 of the Illinois Municipal Code, they actually published the correct ordinance. The facts are clear that they did not. They published the ordinance supported by maps and talking about borrowing $35 million and then presented a factual question to the voters about whether the voters should allow them to borrow $48 million. You're correct that that is part of their argument, but remember that the statute needs to be strictly construed.
Were there any other material differences between the ordinances except the amount of money?
Yes. The $35 million ordinance was much more detailed. It included maps. It included a detailed description of the property.
I understand the detail, but were there conflicts? I don't remember that there were anything other than the amount of money.
Amount of money was different, and that was a conflict.
First one fills in more blanks, basically.
That is correct. And the question is then whether the $48 million ordinance, had it been published, would have been sufficient under 11-117-3, because the question would be whether or not it fairly and accurately described the property, the plant, the equipment that was proposed to be acquired. That's a question that we don't need to confront today because they never published that ordinance. They put that question on the ballot, but what they published in the ordinance was actually only a $35 million ordinance. I see that I'm eating into my rebuttal time. If there are other questions that the panel has that you'd like me to answer now, I will. Otherwise, I'll see you after opposing counsel's argument.
Thank you, Mr. Gale. Mr. Cox?
May it please the Court, my name is Gregory Cox. I'm one of the Village Council for the Village of Rockton, which is the defendant appellee in this case. Judge, what this case amounts to is a challenge to a municipal election which occurred in April of 2005.
Isn't it, though? I mean, I don't see it that way. It seems to me it's Rock Energy's effort to try to stop a process of eminent domain that it sees as pretty far along the road in light of that election, and which may or may not be far enough along the road to stop. But it seems to me, particularly after the state court decision, which I guess you may be appealing, they're worried that you are going to move forward with the eminent domain proceedings.
But
with the election as a predicate.
Well, Judge, you made a good point earlier that being worried about that and having it actually occur are two entirely different things. That issue is not even ripe yet because no eminent domain action has as yet been filed. While the village does have that authority, you correctly noted that municipalities have general eminent domain authority and could condemn any property at any time for a public purpose.
What steps would the village have to take if it decided tomorrow that now's the time to proceed to try to acquire those assets?
It would have to file suit for eminent domain.
Go to a state court and just file an action, and then this ordinance would be one of the predicates that would be alleged in that complaint. Yes, we had an ordinance. Yes, we have the approval of the voters for $48 million. Would that be part of it?
That is correct, Your Honor.
If the village sought to acquire the utility through eminent domain, would you agree that Rock Energy could challenge that proceeding, that it would have standing to challenge that proceeding on the grounds that the village lacks authority because of procedural flaws in the election?
No, Your Honor.
You would not?
I would not. It does have the ability to challenge the eminent domain proceeding itself under the various procedures available to it under the eminent domain statute.
Well, I thought that was what Judge Rover. And so let's assume there is the eminent domain procedure. Why can't Rock Energy say one of the requirements for the village's eminent domain has not been satisfied? You say there's an ordinance, but it's really a nullity. Why can't you think they can't argue that in the eminent domain, this hypothetical eminent domain lawsuit that hasn't been filed yet, but if it were filed?
I don't believe they can, Judge, because 11-117-3 is designed solely to give the voters the opportunity to make an informed decision to approve a referendum.
I understand this is a situation that, but they've suffered injury. In fact, suppose there was never an election at all. Do you think Rock Energy at that point could say you can't proceed with eminent domain because there's no election?
I think they could do that, yes, had there
been. Then why can't they do this?
Because I think that there are vehicles to challenge the election process which are reserved for voters.
But it hasn't been injured yet from the election process until there is an eminent domain procedure. Its interests are not engaged at all until there's an eminent domain procedure.
But I think the other interesting feature, Judge, of the election code is that it is designed to bring finality to an election process. This is an election that occurred in April of 2005.
So you might have to have a new election, that's all, with the right ordinance published.
But I think that this particular election, under the election code, referenda question that was passed by the voters became presumptively valid 5 days after it was passed under the election code. No challenge was made by a voter then. No challenge was made by a voter following the election.
But the voters aren't the ones who were injured.
Judge, if I may, I think this is akin to a situation where perhaps a school board passes a building referendum and then the contractor complains about the way in which it's being paid for its work. The contractor wouldn't be allowed to challenge the building referendum. He would just be allowed to challenge the relationship that he had with the school district.
Well, in your view, how would a person or entity facing an eminent domain proceeding challenge the process through which the village gained authority to acquire property by eminent domain? Is Rock Energy without a remedy here?
It's not without a remedy as to the effect of the authority, because I think that those things, and I noted this in the brief, need to be separated from one another. It is the use of the authority which brings into play Rock Energy's potential proprietary interest in its properties, not the referendum authority itself, which was an issue for the voters.
But you did agree that if the village behaves in an entirely ultra vires manner and tries to acquire this without any referendum at all, you agreed a minute ago that Rock Energy would be entitled to say, you have no authority to bring this eminent domain action against us because you haven't complied with Illinois law.
I believe that is the case.
Well, then what's the answer?
I think the ship has sailed here, Judge. They didn't bring any kind of a timely challenge. No voter raised a challenge. In this instance, they even sat on their rights for 4.5 years.
Why would the voter raise a challenge?
I don't believe there is any need for a voter to raise a challenge in this instance.
This is like Alice in Wonderland. Hi, Alice. You know, the district court seemed to believe that this is an action under the election code, and the court cited that 10 ILCS 5/23-24 in support. The way I read that provision, and you help me if I'm wrong, it gives voters the right to challenge the outcome of an election, to challenge the vote count, for example, but not the process that led up to placing an issue on the ballot. So I just don't. I just don't see how, you know, in your view, there's any hope for Rock Energy at all.
The process for challenging the election question itself is contained in 10 ILCS 5/10-8. And under that provision, a voter within 5 days of the filing of the referenda question can petition to have that question held invalid.
But you think there's no way at all for the target of the condemnation ever to challenge anything? The voters can say, fine, spend all the money we want, acquire, you know, cemeteries, acquire utility assets, acquire rivers, acquire whatever, and there's absolutely no way that the owner can say, you are proceeding against me in an unauthorized fashion.
I think what comes into play then is you're looking at the general eminent domain power. This conferred the power upon the village. After that, there's the, you know, is it a proper public purpose? Is, you know,
no, but so the other you ruled features. Out the ability to challenge one of the predicates to the use of eminent domain power, and it's just striking as odd that one very important predicate is beyond challenge in your view.
I believe because of the election process in this instance and the election code that is, Judge, the authority of the village to have eminent domain power, I believe, is beyond the purview of Rock Energy to challenge. Whether or not Rock Energy, the village properly exercises that is a whole other matter.
No, and I understand what you're saying, I think, but it strikes me that the problem is that the state of Illinois might have delegated plenary eminent domain power to villages like Rockton, in which case, as you say, you know, it would just be ordinary eminent domain questions that would be entertainable. Or, as seems to be the case, the state of Illinois itself might have cabined that eminent domain power in certain ways and said to a village like Rockton, you have a few hoops to jump through before you can exercise it. And so that's why I think one sees this on the eminent domain side of the equation, not the election side. Once you are trying to use your eminent domain power without complying with Illinois law properly, aren't you going beyond the power that the state has chosen to give to the village?
Well, Judge, I think that the difference becomes here, and that as a non-home rule municipality, the difference is that rather than being able to simply exercise that authority, the village is required to ask its citizenry
Correct.
If it can.
That's right. So the state of Illinois has, in fact, imposed an important democratically based limit on the village's eminent domain power. And if it proceeds to try to condemn something without satisfying that properly, then isn't the target of the eminent domain, isn't the entity owning the assets or the land or whatever it may be that's going to be acquired injured, wholly apart from whatever injury the voters may feel?
Now, I think it's separate and distinct because ultimately the third party is subject to the plenary power of the eminent domain.
Well, that may be where we are having a problem, because the third party might be able to argue that it can rely on the limitations that Illinois law has imposed on the village's eminent domain power, just as it can rely, just as the village can rely on whatever's left over.
But what's at issue here, Judge, is that the state legislature decided that the village must ask its voters for permission. In this instance, the voters did give permission, and no voter challenged that permission. As far as a third party goes, their challenge is to the plenary use of that power, not to the existence of the power.
Yeah, but the election code provision that was cited by the district court allows challenges to the result of the election, but not to the process leading up to it. It's also circular.
Well, there is a provision, as I stated, Judge, Section 5/10-8 of the election code does provide for the very kind of challenge that you suggest by a voter to say, I don't believe that that referendum question you wish to put on the ballot, Village, has been properly presented. If that is not done in a timely fashion, then it becomes presumptively valid. And judges, it is the, as I say, it is the use versus the authority, I think, that is the issue here. They can challenge the use of that authority, but not, they do not have standing as a voter to challenge the issuance of the authority. And we would ask in this instance that the ruling of the district court be affirmed. Certainly, this is a situation where Rock Energy has sat on its rights to the extent that it had any, for a great period of time. It engaged in negotiations for a voluntary sale of the property, which would have been in keeping with the grant of authority. Because if you notice, 11-117-3 also requires the village to have the authority to acquire it by agreement and negotiation. When they entered into a memorandum of understanding with the village, some 4.5 years ago, they didn't raise the issue then that, hey, Village, you do not have the authority to enter into this contract. They happily signed a contract which they presented to the Village, and we went through negotiations for a 4.5 year period before this lawsuit was filed. So it's, they want to have their cake and eat it too with regard to whether or not there's authority of the Village to move forward with this purchase. They're fine with it if it can be done through agreement. They're not fine with it if it's done through condemnation. And I think, again, to I see I'm almost out of time to go through the issue that has been raised by Judge Wood with relation to the ripeness of that situation. No eminent domain proceeding has yet been filed. There is no standing conferred there. And to the extent that they were paid fair market value, which is required under the eminent domain statute, if it were initiated, they would sustain no damage. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Cox. Mr. Scale? Scale, why did it take so long for Rock Energy to arrive at the position it has today?
During the intervening period between when the ordinance was passed and when we filed our lawsuit, that our plates were full in dealing with the village. We did not sit on our rights.
Plates were full. You've got an ordinance that obviously you feel is defective, that signals the intention of the to make a pretty significant move on your property.
Let me try to help with the timeline.
Okay.
When the ordinance was passed, we were in the process of bidding for the assets of Alliant, that bidding for the assets of what were then South Beloit Water, Gas, and Electric. So, and we were in negotiations even then with the village, and the village was making threats that they would make it difficult for us to close the transaction. So that we could get our bid in and so that we could try to purchase these assets, we entered into the Memorandum of Understanding. It says what it says. A court has already adjudicated whether or not it's enforceable. That was June 30th of 2005 that we signed the Memorandum of Understanding, and then our bid went in on July 1st and was accepted by Alliant Energy. During the intervening period, we worked back and forth with the village to see if we could reach some sort of agreement. During that period of time, we asked the village to send to us the ordinance that had been passed. We asked the county clerk, we asked the city clerk and council for the village. We got in two different ordinances. It was at that point in time that we realized there was a problem. That was after we had signed the Memorandum of Understanding. We certainly raised with the village early and often that we thought that this was a problem. We did not shut down negotiations with them. We continued to talk to them about the Memorandum of Understanding. When those negotiations broke down, we ultimately filed our lawsuit.
So you were making it clear to the village that they were without the power of eminent domain. Is that your position?
We said that again and again over the course of that period of time between when the Memorandum of Understanding was signed and when we actually filed our lawsuit.
Was there a position taken that there would be no new ordinance passed? Was that part of the understanding?
They've certainly had every opportunity to pass another ordinance, and they've chosen not to do so. To get to Your Honor's through the looking glass sort of perspective on this, I think that you're absolutely correct. If one were to, let's say that I owned land right on the outskirts of the village of Brockton, and they decided to annex that land. I'm not a voter in the village. I live outside the village limits. Would I have absolutely no way to challenge that? That's not a correct interpretation of Illinois law. Of course I would be able to challenge that. These are my client's assets. My client never claimed to have voted in the election. My client is a rural electric cooperative. But they own that land. And what my client seeks to do is protect its rights. And it's a direct injury that has happened today because this ordinance is directed only at my client's assets. And time is running out in which they could even issue bonds so that they could purchase this land. They said in their complaint, first of all, they said in the memorandum of understanding that they were going to forego condemning on these assets, which they had planned to do. I believe that's paragraph 8 of the memorandum of understanding. The memorandum of understanding is attached as Exhibit A, part of Exhibit A to our opposition to their motion to dismiss. So it would be record site 10-1 would be the exhibit that includes both their complaint and the memorandum of understanding. And also in that very state court complaint, they make clear that they had planned to condemn on the assets until a memorandum of understanding was signed. The memorandum of understanding has now been adjudicated to be unenforceable and ineffective. What's to stop them at this point? If there are no further questions.
Let me just ask you to tell us why this isn't just a important to your client, obviously, a zoning dispute that between a municipal entity and a private, privately owned a corporation, so that where are the limits to who can come through that door with zoning in a federal court? What sets this gives us our underlying jurisdiction?
I understand. Jurisdiction is based in diversity here.
Well,
the reason why this isn't a zoning case is because they seek not to just tell us how we can use our assets. They seek to take our assets away.
Well, that can fall under the rubric of zoning, too. Right?
In a certain level, it could. It could. That's fair. But, for example, if one were to look at Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 71.1, subsection K, it specifically envisions that certain state court eminent domain proceedings, state law eminent domain proceedings, could be filed and pursued in federal court. The Pelfresny case that we cite in our papers is an eminent domain proceeding that is brought, it's brought pursuant to Illinois state law, eminent domain, brought by an out-of-state landowner against a village in the state of Illinois, I think Lindenhurst, who tried to take that away. So the question becomes, what is this court's jurisdiction? And it's based in diversity. Now,
I understand the diversity aspect. So, but I'm trying to cabin your case
okay. So
that it doesn't stand for every diverse citizen faced with a eminent domain / zoning issue.
I understand.
To find their way to a federal court when it seems to me more naturally or in many cases resides in the state court.
I think that like any other case that would be here on diversity, for example, because there's no federal question. So forget about 1331. We're looking at 1332. So under diversity, to test substantiality to determine whether or not it's worthy to come to the federal court, one looks at the amount in controversy. And the amount in controversy here, from our perspective, is well in excess of $75,000.
Serious question on that.
I feel like I'm not answering your question.
No, I appreciate your position. I understand.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Gale.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cox. The case is taken under advisement.